I've known Frank, I guess, about 28 years, and he's one of my best friends. I'm Tom. I'm an alcoholic. Don't worry about who I am. This is an anonymous. This is an anonymous program. Oh, where was I? Frank is a piece of work, as you'll hear tonight. He's been sober, I think, 28 years, something like that, somewhere in that area. He'll let you know. Anyway, you know, I've come to know him as somebody I can rely on, and he's seen me at my best and pretty much at my worst. And with that, I give you Frank.
I'm Frank Waters, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I've known Tom almost 27 years. I met him on January 1st, 1990, after an AA dance. We were both trying to shag the same girl. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You could say I won, but I'm not so sure about that after thinking about it. My sobriety date is 10/31/89. I'll have a birthday soon if all works out. I came to AA pretty broken. I don't like telling parts of my story because parts of them hurt. Parts of them, you know, feed into my ego. But, I came to AA to make it look good for a judge because I was going to prison. And at least my lawyer said I was going to prison. And anyway, so I came to meetings. Came to an AA meeting at Biscayne Room. I knew the Atlanta Biscayne Room. I knew where Biscayne was because I'd bought a book there for one of my wife's friends that had trouble once. And so I went there for a meeting. It was a night owls meeting. And I sat down on the couches in the back and people got up and moved. And not because I smelled bad or anything like that. You know, I'd showered and shaved, what I shaved back then. And they just got up and moved to different parts of the room. And after the meeting, this little woman came up to me and kept talking to me and would not leave me alone. She probably weighed up, 105 pounds. Her name was Mary Ellen Kay. She probably still weighs about 105 pounds. And so finally she went away, and my wife at the time came and picked me up, and I went home. And I got home, I got to thinking that, I was supposed to be going to meetings for this judge. So I didn't want to lie. So I went back the next night because I knew on Sunday y'all would be closed because y'all are a religious organization. I figured everybody would be at church somewhere. So I went back the next night. Same thing happened. Except this time people left about this much room and sat on the couch next to me. There's a room for another person, but they weren't getting that close. And same thing happened. You know, I got up to go get coffee. And at Biscayne, there was like a little aisle way to get up through there. Everybody wants to stand there and talk. And I started going towards those people, and they just parted. Like, Jesus had come in the room. And I got the coffee, and I came back. They parted again. It seemed like nobody wanted to get that close to me. And sat back down. And I needed proof that I was at meetings, I thought, so... They started giving out the chips, and then went through the white chip. I'm like, holy shit, I need a chip to show this judge. So I stood up, and everybody started clapping because it was the 30-day chip. And I'm like, no, don't clap. It's just it's a white chip. And they still kept on clapping. So I went up to the front of the room, and this guy named Terry A. was giving out the chips. You know, at the time, I was a little bigger than I am now. And Terry was huge. He was like a bear. He's still big. And I didn't know you guys hugged. You know, 27 years ago, I was a bit more homophobic than I am today. And I got the chip from Terry, and he grabbed me when I had both my arms down, and I was just, like, embarrassed. Because everybody started clapping and whatever y'all do, you know, and hooping and hollering, and it's like, oh, dear God, if this fucker ever lets, excuse me, if this guy ever lets go of me, I am going to kill him. And he finally did, and I just turned and walked back to my seat all red-faced, and he went on with the chips, and after the meeting, that little woman came up to me again and started running her mouth again, just talking and talking and talking. I'm like, Jesus. And I would grunt at her. I can't remember what she said. Turns out she was an evaluator for drug and alcohol addiction for an insurance company. But she's the only one that would speak to me. And so that Monday, I went to court, and I got off. Got 2 more years without a license. And about a week went by, and I was at home, and I got to wondering what that little woman was doing. Because back then, nobody really spoke to me unless they had to, like a cashier or something like that. Nobody spoke to me really. I guess I had this presence. And but the reason I was going for before that judge was I got my second DUI on an HV probationary license. Now, most of you know that HV is a habitual violator. 20-some-odd years ago, they stamped that across your license in big red letters. And being, you know, and I was a carpenter, so I drove all the time, not just to work. I worked everywhere. So I would have to present that HV license to cashiers and things to when they want to clear a check. Back then, we wrote checks. And sometimes I think we still do. I just hadn't seen any in a long time. And so they would ask what the HV was for. And being the quick-witted, smart guy that I am, trying not to cuss, in case you couldn't tell that, I would say, oh, I'm a highway volunteer for the Georgia State Patrol. As soon as I get off probation, it'll just say HV. And they'd buy that, you know. And, you know, I would, you know, flag traffic. You know, if there's an accident somewhere, I'd be first on the scene. I would, you know, apply first aid, things like that. You know, I was an upstanding individual. And when I got my second DUI with that license, and I used to drive aggressively. And anyway, I had the HV, I got a DUI. When they pulled me over, I had every weapon I owned in the car. I was smoking 2 joints and drinking a beer because I just buried my oldest son. And some friends of mine thought I needed to go out and cut loose. And I had to drop my friend off, and I was pulling down the street, and the city of Atlanta pulled me over. And my friend's wife came down. You know, they were all going. They're going to turn me loose because of the situation, and you know, I just buried him. And they couldn't do that because everything is recorded on their radios. When they call in, it's on recording. And that was, you know, was already been documented as having a DUI. So with that and going to the judge decided that I didn't need to go to prison. I would just get 2 more years of my driving privileges suspended. So I kept a lot of guilt over that for the next good while because, you know, my son's death had kept me out of prison. And, of course, you know, like being any good alcoholic, you know, I worked out for 3 or 4 days hard. So hard I could barely move. My muscles were so sore because I was going to prison and I'm going to have to defend myself. You know? So, God, I was sore. I didn't go to prison. They sent me downstairs to file traffic tickets for a day. And after about a week of being back home with my wife at the time and her mother, the people that were supposed to be watching my son when he drowned in the backyard, I was wondering what that little skinny woman was doing back over Biscayne. So I started getting rides back over there just to get away from them. And so see, I don't have one of those stories where, you know, I was always in a ditch somewhere, or lost everything, or sleeping in a dumpster. I had just been emotionally wrecked. And I did things back then that, you know, that I'm not proud of or want to tell you a whole lot about. But I just wanted to go ahead and get that part of my story out of the way. I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm from Atlanta. And back then, the city limits weren't quite as big, so I'm from Atlanta. I was born at Crawford Long Hospital. My father drank. My mother didn't. My father drank a lot. He got in a lot of fights. And I grew up with that. I grew up with my father making muscadine wine in the bathtub. We had a muscadine and vines in the backyard, and him and his buddies, and he'd come home bleeding from the neck, where you're getting stuck with a beer bottle, getting in a fight, just things like that. You know, I was going to be like my dad when I got bigger. And growing up back then, you know, you had cigarette commercials on TV, you had liquor commercials on TV. That's what men did on the movies I watched, you know, Jack Palance or, you know, any of these old Western guys, you know, whether they were at Humphrey Bogart, they all drank and they all smoked. And that's just what men did. That's the way I processed that. Men drank and smoked and raised hell and chased women. And that's just what I thought. And when I was 14, I went to live with my father. And I was a big kid at 14. Back then, there weren't big kids. Big kids were kind of odd. But they had these drive-through windows in package stores where you could just drive up in a car and get what you wanted. And I was a big kid, so I'd buy beer and wine and whatever for my buddies and tell them it was for my dad's poker party, but they never asked for ID. I mean, you know, I didn't have a learner's permit when I was buying alcohol from the liquor store. So I was fairly popular in that regard when I was growing up. And I was a blackout drinker from the start. And I wouldn't quit. I just wouldn't quit. And my father drank all the time. I was taught to drive his Cadillac when I got a permit with him drinking, and so he could drink and I could drive. And that's just the way, you know, I grew up. I grew up in Cobb County. And I spent some time in Decatur, or they call No Man's Land. This is between Decatur and Avondale city limits. I grew up there a little bit. And my mother's side of the family, we just raised hell all the time. We were getting our ass beat constantly on a daily basis, and not three or four times a day. We would just do things that kids these days don't do. But I got sent to South Georgia when I was 17 years old, somewhere in there. I was going to school up here. And my father was losing his second wife, and he sent me down to my grandparents to spend the summer. I wound up staying down there, and while I was down there in 75, I joined the Marine Corps, and my father had a spiritual experience. One of those you don't really hear about very often, but he came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so about halfway through the school year, I got sent back up to Atlanta to live with my father now that he was sober. And my father still had the same Cadillac. And AAs, as most of us can attest to, are kind of lazy sometimes. So they would send me in a Cadillac over to Bronner's Hospital to pick up drunks and bring them back to a meeting. It was the AA, in that regard, was the best thing I had ever come across. I got loose with my father's car. I got to run down the highway with it. Because Bronner's wasn't that close. It was like 6 or 7 miles from Rebus. And I hung around the drunks over at Rebus, and they had a little thing at the front of the room, a telephone. It was like a juror's box, like for a witness to testify from. And so, being lazy as they were, I knew a lot of them, so they'd park me up there in that thing during the meetings, because back then you didn't turn the phone off. So when they got a phone call during the meeting, I'd answer it, and I knew who they wanted to talk to, I'd point to them, and they'd come answer the phone. And they got tired, and they got to thinking I was spending too much time around alcoholics, and made me go to Alateen meetings. That didn't last long, but so I was kind of a fixture, but I knew you guys were a religious cult because of the way the effect you had on my father. And I had a resentment about that because I'd planned on doing a lot of drinking with my father. And AA had taken him from me. And I was there and I saw a bunch of wet drunks, and I've seen people that I know, commit suicide that had some years. And, this is typical life on life's terms, things that come around us, houses burning down, everybody gets together and pulls a person back out. So I was exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous in that regard, of how you kind of take up for each other, but back then they were just mean people. I don't know about the rest of y'all, but Rebus was. Since I got transferred from South Georgia back to Atlanta, my transcripts had got messed up, and they told me I wasn't going to be able to graduate in June. And so I decided to go into the Marine Corps early. And I did. So I went in the Marine Corps in January of 76. I was already enlisted, but I went on active duty in 76. And the Marine Corps, did a lot of things for me or to me. My father says that the Marine Corps calmed me down. He never was really clear about how he meant that, but he said that frequently, that they had calmed me down. The Marine Corps taught me to take orders without question, something I didn't bring into rooms. They told me how to kill with extreme prejudice. And basically, that's what military people are. And I was young and impressionable. And so I did my time in the Marine Corps in Europe and in the Far East and came back and got out. Because I was 21 years old. And to, get a retirement from the Marine Corps, I would be ancient. My life would be over. I'd be 37. I was like, there's no way in hell I can last that long. The world would just be over. I didn't say I was the smartest tool in the shed. But so I got out, and I've always had the opposite effects of drugs worked up. They worked opposite on me. If you gave me something to calm me down, it would hype me up. Something to hype me. Well, nobody ever gave anything to hype me up, but they tried to calm me down in the hospitals. It would take five or six people to hold me down before they could strap me. So I didn't do a lot of drugs because I didn't see the point. But I would smoke cigarettes of the other nature with people. And one day coming back from Europe, I finally got stoned, and it was all a big thing. Everybody said, "Oh, he's getting stoned. Mist's getting stoned." One of my Marine Corps nicknames was Mist. And so they all felt it their duty to get me stoned often. I'd gotten stoned one other time on some horse tranquilizers aboard ship and started hallucinating. And I was on guard duty with a shotgun. And my buddies took that shotgun away from me and decided I should never do, horse tranquilizers again. I was bending things and threatening people, and it wasn't good. So I spent some time in Europe, and coming back, the pot was really good. I missed the hash bars in Africa, but at the time it didn't affect me. Let's move right along. So I got out of the Marine Corps. And I continued to use marijuana with drinking. And it took a lot more to get me stoned, but still, I was just buying it for me. I wasn't buying it for anybody else. And I lived in my truck for a while, just ran around different places, people's houses. I'd show up at my dad's house out of the blue. Of course, I didn't call or anything. I'd show up at my grandmother's house in South Georgia. I didn't call. I'd just show up. And So this went on for a little bit, and this woman decided we were going to get married, because I said I wasn't going to get married until I was 25. Well, I turned 25 in June. I was married in July, because I had said I'd get married after 25, so I married her. And we had a couple kids, and the oldest of which you heard, he drowned. He was a daddy's boy. And he was big baby, all muscles. And my second son was a little scrawny little weasel-looking kid. And he was a mama's boy, and to this day he still is. He loves his daddy, but he's still a mama's boy. And so after this had happened, and I went to Biscayne to save myself from prison, I started going back to Biscayne because I didn't want to be at home with those women. My wife was watching my son, and she'd gone in the other room to hear some hot gossip from her mother in the other room when all this happened. So I started going to Biscayne, where there was a room manager there named Bobby Raynard. And he told me, he says, well, if you're going to stay around here, you're going to have to, do some work. So on Fridays and Saturdays, I mopped the floors. And the Night Owls group decided I needed a job. So on Fridays and Saturday nights, I had to wash the coffee cups and ashtrays. And nobody ever cleaned the ashtrays like I wanted them cleaned. Of course, Marine. And the coffee cups back then, they had that lipstick that wouldn't come off in a pool. Well, it would damn sure come off on a coffee cup. And then it didn't want to come off of that. But after about a month or so of that, maybe 2 months, I came in one night and I was going back to the kitchen to do my chores. And they had somebody else in there washing the coffee cups and ashtrays. And I said, oh, hell no. These are my coffee cups and ashtrays. This is my job. And you guys, he tricked me into taking part in my own recovery. And they explained to me, no, he's a newcomer. It's his turn. So I didn't have a job but mopping the floors. It's amazing how we turn that shit around in our heads. Like, I'm doing this. And I heard a lot of talk about people that said you had to have a sponsor. And I would watch, Judy P. was in here a few weeks back. And I would watch people circle around this woman before and after the meetings. And with my keen mind, I knew that she had something on these people, or they wouldn't hang around her. I figured she's got some, got the shit on these people. Got some stuff on these people. And I always tell right before the meeting, y'all are recording this, so I'm trying. I want to bleep out some things. But anyway, so she was talking about the sponsors thing. So I went up to her, and she was a mean, mean woman. She wasn't that nice little grandma you saw up here a few weeks ago. And I asked her about the sponsorship thing. And she just looked up at me, and she goes, honey, if you're going to stay sober in AA, you got to have a sponsor. But if I was you, I wouldn't worry about it, because you're not going to be around here that long anyway. I'm like, now, a lot of people that would send right back out the door. I got mad, now I got sober at her. And I said, I'll show you. Of course, there's some words I'm leaving out there. So, and so then Terry, the guy, gave him a chip. I went to ask him about it. He said, it sounded like a good topic for a meeting. And he walked away from me. See, nobody would want to talk to me. I came in here carrying 7 knives, 2 pistols, and a blackjack everywhere I went. And, when my son passed away, I was in Ohio collecting some money that was owed to a computer company. I did some jobs that, we don't talk about too much. And I'm not going to talk about them too much now. That's just part of my past and where I came from. I was a bouncer in a bar. It was just the people I hung around, that's what you did. You didn't go anywhere unless you were packing something. So these two people were at the head of the room in the two chairs up there at Biscayne and asked if anybody had a topic for a meeting. So I raised my hand. I said, I want to know about this sponsorship thing. They took off. The whole meeting was about sponsorship. And at the end of the meeting, I did one of those newcomer things. I raised my hand, and apologize for taking up the group's time with the topic. I just wanted some feedback on it. I didn't want to take up your whole meeting with it. And Judy just sat up there and says, okay, honey, it's not about you anyway. Which pissed me off some more. I was not liking this woman. And time went on. I went to a Monday night men's meeting. And they went around the room and introduced themselves before the meeting started. You know, nobody talked to me still. And I introduced myself as Frank. I'm an alcoholic because it was what was going around. And so I did that. And, you know, I was also Biscayne's bitch, you know, mopping the floors and doing all the coffee stuff. And you know, the way I, you know, I just saw it, they were just using me. So, and Bobby Rayner would send me out on 13-step calls with people that had, you know, just a few more months than I did. I didn't know that at the time. I figured they were just AAs that knew what they were doing. And he would be, you know, he'd always be thrilled that I came back and hadn't drank. I didn't realize later that who I was going out with was not really a good thing. But back then we had 12-step calls and we were going on them. And weren't as many hospitals back then. Not that that's a long time ago, but for some of you it is. Some of you aren't that old yet. But, Yeah, you. So I made it through those 12-step calls. I made it through Biscayne, and I finally found this guy that was, he had a lot of tattoos, old biker dude, real heavy set, name was Carl S. And he would sit back there, and he was the most jolly old man I think I'd seen in a while. And I said, that's my sponsor right there. So I wouldn't ask him to be my sponsor. He said, yeah. Don't judge your sponsor by outward appearances. I'm still not sure it's a good idea for us to be choosing our sponsors. But back then, nobody didn't want to come up to me and say, I'm your sponsor. Which happened a lot, just not to me. So Carl and I would talk about things. And he made me come over to his house. We'd talk. And one of the things that really just irked me was that nobody ever told me, keep coming back. Or we'll love you to even love yourselves, or any of those things. Nobody shook my hand, or, you know, it just didn't happen for me. And I told Carl, you guys are a bunch of damn hypocrites. You know, you talk all this brotherly love stuff, and, you know, I don't get any of it. And he said, well, have you ever seen yourself talk, or how you look when you walk into a meeting? I said, I'm always clean, shaven, you know, what I shaved back then. And, dressed appropriately, I thought, like you guys are now. He goes, well, he made me go down the hall. He was in his little living room. He made me go down the hall, and there was a mirror on the wall. And look in this mirror and talk to him while he's in the other room. That's incredibly hard for me to do at the time, was to go down the hall and talk to this mirror. I'm talking to myself, and my sponsor's over in the other room listening. So I could see what people saw when I talked, or when I just looked at them. And he said I had to quit going into meetings looking like Rambo. And I was, you know, my first thought was, I don't wear bandanas. I wore, you know, Doc beanies back then. And don't have long hair. I said, what are you talking about? He goes, you go into every meeting you go into, you got knives hanging off of you, the guns are there. I said, well, how do you know they're concealed? And he goes, well, a couple of knives aren't concealed, and that blackjack hangs out of your back pocket. I had one of those old lead ones, you know. And have you ever seen somebody with a big wallet or a can of Skull in their blue jeans? They leave that impression. Mm-hmm. My back pocket left the impression of a 25 automatic. And, you know, me being the articulate person I am, and just I've noticed everything. I never noticed that. But I went home, and every pair of my blue jeans had an impression of a 25 automatic in the back. So he said I had to quit carrying so many knives and the blackjack and any pistols I could carry in my pockets. You know, any links. I said, okay, well, I can still carry this pistol in my jacket. And Carl was my keep it simple sponsor. You know, I come with him anything and he'd just blow me apart in four or five words. And that was the end of the conversation. And I said, well, I still got this pistol in my jacket. He goes, that's okay, summer's coming. So, you know, my first 10 years of my recovery, my sponsors were not my friends, they were my adversaries. They did not go along with anything I thought was a good idea. And they were a lot like my father, because anything I wanted to do and they were against, I said, well, I'll do it different. I know what I'm doing. And it always worked out to where it wasn't a good thing for me to be doing. They were always right. And another, you know, kind of ego buster that's like, you know, I'm getting tired of this shit. These people, you know, it's just, But they were always right. I don't know that I'm always right as a sponsor, but, you know, I throw out the same things they did. So back then you had to get a big book and a 12 and 12 and a dictionary so you'd know what the words were you were reading. Just because you knew what they were didn't mean you knew what they were. So, and I would, because I would go through the big book and I would tell my second sponsor was a guy named Craig Pierce, Judy's husband that spoke a little while back. He would show me where that says it in the book, and I would show him. And he goes, it doesn't say that, it says this. I said, well, that's what it infers. He goes, that's why you have me. I said, what do you mean? He goes, that's a sponsorship, that's the duty of a sponsor, was to, how do you put that? Was to interpret what the book said and not what I thought it said. And, he was to translate it. He was to translate what the book said, not what I was interpreting. That was it. So, and in the meantime, they had given me this old woman named Mary Campbell as a grief sponsor because she had lost a child. And I would have to take Mary to meetings, take her home for meetings, spend Saturdays with her. She had like 55 years when she passed. And it was just, you know, I was doing, you know, babysitting duty with Mary, and she was not the kindly little old lady everybody thought she was. She was crusty. Good God Almighty. I wish I could remember what Mary had told me, because Mary, you know, knew Bill, she knew Lewis, she knew all these people. And I was like, yeah. She was just part of what I had to do. It turns out Mary sponsored both of my first two male sponsors. So you guys were manipulating me without me even knowing it. And I hated God when I got here because I'd lost my son. And so between Mary and Carl and Craig, they helped me find a higher power. And Craig was my, where's God sponsor? Because everything I would say to Craig, he would say, where's God and all that, Frank? I'm like, what the hell has God got to do with this? This is some serious stuff here. God's got nothing to do with it. And that's all that would be his comeback. Where's God in all this? And when I couldn't get Craig on the phone, because back then we didn't have cell phones, he had pagers, and he had public, you know, pay phones everywhere. And I would call Craig, and I would, because Carl had gone to be a prison guard in Buford, I'd call Craig, and he wouldn't be home from work yet, so I would get Judy. And Judy would talk to me for about 3 seconds or 30 minutes, depending on Judy's mood. And so I became real close to Judy. And so they moved to Ohio, offered me to move with them, and I decided I needed to be here next to my youngest son. And I walked along, got another sponsor named Alex. And Alex will tell you that when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, a dark cloud moved into the room. You could tell I wanted to kill people. And I did want to do that. I just didn't want anybody to feel the pain that I had felt from the loss of my son. It was just traumatic. It took me over a decade to be able to talk about this. So, you know, I'm talking about it because it's part of my story in case somebody is out there that has that same thing going on in their lives. It's safe to talk about. Not all stories have to be a comedic review. You can cry through some of them. I know I have. So I went on from Alex, another sponsor, to another sponsor. So the sponsor I have today, it's like my seventh or eighth one. And I can't tell you much about what Paul says other than he says he'll never give up on me. The guy's name is Paul O. from the Napa Club. In case you want to report back that I was up here telling anything I shouldn't be telling. AA has done a lot for me as a process. You know, I used to want to screen the experience that you were giving me, that God was giving me. You know, and it's like it didn't apply, and not even thinking about it. And I got to where I had to think about it. Even though somebody said it and I didn't like it, I should at least consider it. Not usually in their presence, but later. And I've learned to do that a lot. I've learned to, you know, not screen the experience and try to find out what God is trying to tell me. That God of our own understanding is probably what kept me here. I didn't have that God that I grew up with where I was getting spankings two or three or four times a day with a belt or a switch or a razor strop or whatever it was, because I was into devilment, as my great-grandmother would like to say. And I've always been in service in recovery. I've always had a job. Since Bobby Rayner started making me mop the floors and the night owls made me wash the dishes, I've always had a service position, at least one. That could be a lie. I probably always had at least three. At one time I had 13, and I was going insane, and my sponsor at the time told me, I said, I'm quitting. I'm not doing any more of this stuff. It's driving me crazy. He goes, you can't quit doing all this stuff. It will drive you crazy. Just drop everything but three things. I said, well, who's going to do it? He goes, well, you came along. I said, yeah, okay. And, you know, since I have done that, there has been people that will step up occasionally and take service positions. I've been on the NAVA Board of Directors 13 years. Been on the Biscayne Board of Directors 6 or 7 years. I've been the head drunk of NAVA 5 times. And the vice drunk of Biscayne once. Got another vice drunk, so I'm speaking a couple more weeks. I was just thinking, that board over there says, we've had enough, we've had enough, we've had enough. Every time I saw it, we've had enough. Y'all going to have enough of that home group pretty soon. You're going to have another old Marine get up here. AA's given me a lot, more than I could ever imagine. And none of the things I thought that I was capable of, just by being of service. When I had 96... So I had 7 years of recovery. Tom McNally over there, Tom M.C. over there, and a friend of mine named Bill K. decided it was a good time to go to Rock Eagle, to the Atlanta Men's Workshop. I went to that workshop and I didn't sleep 3 hours. I was always up in some sort of meeting, some sort of gathering somewhere. It was the most exhilarating time of my recovery. I could not believe it. And as time went on, I have become more of a part of the Rock. I go up twice a year. I'm on the Cook's crew. It's happening next weekend. I hope to see some of you there. But that was a turning point in my recovery, was finding a higher power and being taken to Rock Eagle, where I didn't have a vehicle I could drive back to Atlanta with. I had to stay. Of course, riding down there with Tom and Bill were another experience, but anyway, I've got 4 or 5 people in this world that I can count on without question. I wouldn't even think about it when I picked up the phone if they would actually do it, help me. And Tom's one of them. Paul's another. Little Lisa. But anyway, AA is blessed, and I came here with one son and a wife. I have 4 plaintiffs. And I have 13 women that call me dad. And I don't have a blood daughter among them, but I was at a birthday party today for one of my grandkids. It's not really my grandkid, but I'm their pappy. And it's just the gifts that I receive are just, they don't quit. Now, sometimes I don't think they're gifts until they get taken away or I abuse them. It's like that... That toolbox full of spiritual tools they lay at your feet. I find that they work for us until I use them as weapons, then they quit working. So not try to hide behind those. You know, my alcoholism is a diagnosis. It's not an escape clause. I can't keep saying, well, you know, I did this because, you know, I'm an alcoholic. You did that because you chose to. because you thought it was the right thing to do at the time, or some sort of self-centered reason you do these things. Believe me, I've broken all the rules of living sober. The book, Living Sober, not actually Living Sober. You know, I don't get on my knees and pray in the mornings. Nowhere in that book does it say we get on our knees and pray. It says we ask God, and we have a conscious contact with a higher power through prayer and meditation. Now, I use my prayer as my conversations with my God. And I talk to him a lot, not just once. I used to do that, and one of the little girls told me, says, do you ever take God with you when you go out in the world? I said, well, no, I pray in the mornings. I have a little meditation. She says, yeah, but do you ask God to come with you? I never thought about that. So since that time, so about the past 15 to 16 years, I ask God to come with me in the mornings. Now, that doesn't mean I always pay attention to him, unless, you know, something happens that I need, you know, some direction. But, you know, I ask God, and we have conversations. Sometimes they're out loud, but nobody's accused me of being insane yet. Just a little crazy here and there. But I'm not the person that came in these rooms. I'm not that gunslinger or that collector that I used to be, or the bouncer or whatever. I am head of security at Biscayne. But that came out of nowhere the other day. But you know, between the people I have, the friends I have in my life today, and what I get to do, I get to go help people move. I get to go, you know, give advice over the phone. I get to answer the phone at night when somebody's crying and you can't figure out what the hell they're saying. Or they're going back out, or they've already gone back out. And, you know, I give them at least a couple minutes where I hang up if they're drunk. It would take a couple, 3 hours probably for me with my memory to regale you with all the benefits I've gotten from being sober. Other than you hear people talk in a meeting and they'll listen to somebody share and say, well, I haven't done that yet. I haven't done that yet. And sometimes these alcoholics will focus in on one person and that'll be their yet man or their yet woman, whatever. You know, I'm not afraid of the yets. They haven't happened. What I'm afraid will happen to me is the agains. I don't want to do some of the things I've done again. I don't want them to happen again. And knowing I've already walked through them. So it's not, you know, I don't have any yet people, but I have my very own again. And it's right inside me. I don't want to do that again. I hate making amends. I do. It's not like I say, oh, let me go make amends. Why'd you screw up to begin with? I hate amends. So I try not to repeat anything I've done in my past that caused me pain or caused somebody else pain. And since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not hit another person. I've not cut anybody. I've not shot anybody. I do tend to piss some people off, but I have not physically hurt anybody since I've been back in these rooms or come in these rooms. I have one white chip. I don't have a relapse. Some of us don't have relapses. I learned real early you had to buy that black suit. You know, John went out and fell in the pool and drowned. And Susie went out there and got drunk and plastered out on the railroad tracks and got run over. You know, you can't tell when you're gonna, you know, when you're gonna shoot up the wrong thing or get a hot ball or something going somewhere. You know, you don't have to do that again. You may not have another recovery. And I'm not willing to chance it. So thank you for being here tonight.